Good, let me draw us together there. I think most people have finished, but if you are still eating, feel very relaxed about that. Do carry on eating. We've come to the focal point of our evening, really. William is going to speak to us on this subject, is Britain Christian? And now would be a very good moment, if you've got a mobile phone, to switch it to silent. You don't want to be that person halfway through the talk. Let me tell you a little bit about William. He's the senior minister here at St. Helens. He's married to Janet. He's got three grown-up children. He served as an officer in the British Army before moving into Christian ministry, and he's been the rector here at St. Helens for the best part of 15 years. So without further ado, I'm going to hand over to him now, William.
Go ahead and do that. Jamie, thank you very much indeed, and may I welcome you very warmly indeed to St. Helens this evening, especially, I guess for many of us, it may be our first ever trip inside these walls, and if that's you, I'm really, really glad you've been able to join us this evening. Just before I got up to speak, the person sitting next to me looked to me and very sincerely said, "Good luck." So I realise that, you know, I've taken on what I suspect is quite a hot topic. That Britain has a Christian heritage is undeniable. Emerge from Bank Tube, look directly ahead of you, there on the Royal Exchange, carved in large letters, "The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof," Psalm 24. Head south across London Bridge, look up to your right, carved in the stone, "Glorify God." Cycle north up the London Wall, carved into the wrought iron gates, "Honour God." And so our Christian heritage is quite literally carved in stone before our very eyes. Not simply the architecture of our public buildings, St. Paul's Cathedral, Westminster, churches and chapels across the nation, but also our language. Up here above me, to my right, your left, Shakespeare. It has been rightly said repeatedly, you cannot understand the writings of Shakespeare without a working knowledge of the Bible. We speak of an eye for an eye. Do unto others. Love your neighbour. Going the extra mile. Somebody being found weighed and wanting. And I could go on and on and on and on. The very language we use in our public discourse is shot through with Christian reference. And then there's the national and the institutional life. Whatever any of us may make of it, and I guess there will be quite a number of different views here, whatever any of us may make of it, we have a state church. The monarch is head of the Church of England. We sing "God Save Our Gracious Queen." And then we call our senior politicians ministers, literally servants. A profoundly Christian idea, and the leading elected minister in our nation is the prime servant. We speak of the armed services. We enjoy holidays, public holidays at Christmas and Easter. What nation other than a Christian nation could have produced the national service, health service? And so I repeat that it is undeniable that Britain has a Christian heritage. And I haven't even touched on the laws of our land, the protection of the vulnerable, our deep concern for the alien and the stranger, our labour laws, which in question time you can ask me about, profoundly impacted, our child protection laws, and so forth. And yet... You know, we would have to be profoundly ignorant of our recent history if we were to demand that Britain is Christian today. At the turn of the millennium, Dr. Callum Brown produced and published this book, The Death of Christian Britain. From 1956, all indices of religiosity in Britain started to decline. From 1963, most enter free fall. They began levelling off during the 1970s and 1980s and fell again in the 1990s to a catastrophic rate. All figures show the scale of declension, an unremitting decline in membership, communicants, baptisms, religious marriage, which at the start of the third millennium shows no sign of bottoming it out. And here is his last two sentences. The culture of Christianity has gone in the Britain of the new millennium. Britain is showing the world how religion, as we have known it, can die. And so here we got these two views, and as part of my preparation, hoping to have more than good luck as a kind of a motto to run through this talk, I reread what I think is amongst the most famous of C.S. Lewis's highly stimulating essays. It was written, interestingly, in 1946, The Decline of Religion. He begins by charting the decline of church attendance amongst undergraduates returning from the war in the 1940s. Remember, he was Don, first of all, at Cambridge and then Professor of English at Oxford. Here he is in 1946. One way of putting the truth would be that the religion which has declined was not Christianity. It was a vague belief in God with a strong moral code that was absorbed into the whole fabric of English institutions and sentiment. It was, and listen to this, mere religion. It was morality tinged with emotion. It was what a person does in their solitude. It was the religion of all good men. So is Britain Christian? Was Britain Christian? What I want to do, therefore, in order to bring a degree of clarity, and I hope help us begin to answer this hot topic, is to go back to the earliest record we have of a Christian sermon preached to a non-Jewish audience. The date is sometime in the 30s AD. I would place it between 35 and 37 AD. I can tell you why in the questions. The speaker is the Apostle Peter, the one on whose teaching Jesus said he would build his church. The audience is a group of non-Jewish people. And this sermon was preached in Israel at Caesarea by Peter on the eve of Christianity's explosion into the then pagan world. And therefore, by all accounts, this is a hugely important address for the understanding of genuine Christianity. Is Britain Christian? Well, let's hold up, if you like, the programmatic sermon recorded by Dr. Luke, a medical doctor, in the book of Acts, on the eve of Christianity's explosion out of Israel into the pagan world. It's put here for a reason, so that we might know what authentic Christianity is. So that we've got a benchmark, do you see? A measure, a plumb line against which to measure authentic Christianity. And that then, I think, begins to give us some solid ground on which to answer the question. So I've asked Ronti here to read for us. She's going to read from what is Acts chapter 10 and verse 34. And you'll find in the middle of your table a little card there. I'm sorry we haven't given you a whole Bible to look at. We could have done, but it's rather cluttersome. And so Ronti's going to stand up and read these words of the Apostle Peter to the Gentiles gathered in Cornelius' house in first century Caesarea. Ronti.
So Peter opened his mouth and said, "Truly I understand that God shows no partiality, but in every nation, anyone who fears him and does what is right is acceptable to him. As for the word that he sent to Israel, preaching good news of peace through Jesus Christ, he is Lord of all, you yourselves know what happened throughout all Judea, beginning from Galilee after the baptism that John proclaimed. How God anointed Jesus of Nazareth with the Holy Spirit and with power. He went about doing good and healing all who were oppressed by the devil, for God was with him. And we are witnesses of all that he did, both in the country of the Jews and in Jerusalem. They put him to death by hanging him on a tree, but God raised him on the third day and made him to appear, not to all the people, but to us who had been chosen by God as witnesses, who ate and drank with him after he rose from the dead. And he commanded us to preach to the people and to testify that he is the one appointed by God to be judge of the living and the dead. To him all the prophets bear witness that everyone who believes in him receives forgiveness of sins through his name.
Bronte, thank you very much indeed for reading. Here is a speech. I mean, we're used to tackling and studying speeches. We had an American friend to stay, and I took him to the cabinet war rooms because I thought he'd be really interested in the history coming to America. And it was only halfway round studying Churchill and so forth that he told me that his other interest, apart from his PhD in the history of Britain in the 18th century, was Churchill. And he'd been there about 5,000 times. But anybody who's got any interest in history, sociology, anthropology, philosophy, religion, this is a key speech. Because it defines for us what is the essence of arguably the biggest movement of humanity in the last 2,000 years. And there are three things that you find at the heart of it. It's beautifully structured. First, the essential message of Christianity. Secondly, the well-attested facts of the Christian faith. And then finally, the God-given meaning. And I want us to look at the essential message. And one of the things that I always ask people before they come and work for us here is, as part of the interview, just don't tell anybody this, but as part of the interview, it goes like this. Will you please explain to me the Christian faith in less than 15 words? I wonder if you could do that. Now, Peter does it here for us in sentence or verse number 36 in either 6 words or 9 words, depending whether you want the abridged or the longer version. Here is the 6 words. The end of verse 36, Jesus Christ is Lord of all. And if you want the 9-word version, peace. Through Jesus Christ, he is Lord of all. And you can see straight away that this is a direct challenge to the kind of rather vague concept of God with a strong moral code, which C.S. Lewis suggested was knocking around in the middle of the 20th century. Lord in the Bible means what it says, Lord. Lord of all leaves us in no doubt. Christ in the Bible means an anointed king, anointed by God, the one appointed by him to rule over everybody and to judge them at the end. So here is the heart of the Christian message. Jesus Christ is Lord of all. 6 words. And the longer version, peace, through Jesus Christ who is Lord of all. Peace in the Bible means reconciliation, friendship. Friendship with God. And therefore, this message that is being spoken at the time to the Roman centurion, the members of whose centuria or cohort have been drawn from across the Roman Empire, who himself was not an Israelite, is this. Jesus Christ is Lord of all. You can have peace with God in and through Jesus Christ, who is Lord of all. Peace, a technical word meaning friendship. So here then is the heart of the Christian message, a personal friendship with the maker of the universe, such that I can call him father, he can call me son or daughter, is available to all through Jesus Christ, who is Lord of all. Last week I was in Riga. I recommend it. It's such a beautiful city in a wonderful country. We took off out of Riga Airport. I had a window seat looking down over much of the Baltic, Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania. Peace with Jesus, with peace with God through Jesus Christ, who is Lord of all. Our journey took us west through Denmark. There is Copenhagen, one of the most multicultural cities of Western Europe. Jesus Christ is Lord of all. And then southwest across the Dutch coast, boats, tiny specks as you look down the window. You know how it is at night? There's a tiny speck, boats queuing to get into Amsterdam docks from all over the world. Jesus Christ is Lord of all. You can have peace with God through him. And then down into London, well, Stansted, Liverpool Street, Borough. Lord of all, Lord of all. Now, on its own, that such a claim is pure theory, but that is the essential message of the Christian faith. And so I want to ask you, you know, is, in your view, Britain Christian? Has it ever been? I suppose on its own it is pure theory. I mean, I could say Jamie, who led the evening, or is leading the evening, is Lord of all. And you'd say, well, show me. Or I could say, you know, Tony Blair was Lord of all. And you'd say, well, show me. Or Barack Obama is Lord of all. And you'd say, well, show me. And so what Peter does in the next phase of this definition of the Christian faith for us is to move from the essential message to the well-attested facts. And you find those in verse 37 through to 40. You yourselves know. That's fascinating, isn't it? You yourselves know, he says to his audience in first century Israel, what happened throughout all Judea, beginning from Galilee after the baptism that John proclaimed, how God anointed Jesus of Nazareth with the Holy Spirit with power. He went about doing good and healing all who were oppressed by the devil, for God was with him. And we are witnesses of all that he did, both in the country of the Jews and in Jerusalem. They put him to death by hanging him on a tree, but God raised him on the third day and made him to appear, not to all the people, but to us who have been chosen by God as witnesses, who ate and drank with him after he rose from the dead. Here then are the facts of the Christian faith, the evidential base for Peter's claim. And we could spend hours and hours on this, just as we could spend hours and hours on the first point. The public life of Jesus began with John the Baptist. Verse 37, he announced the arrival of this divine king. And you can read of the ministry of John the Baptist in all of the Gospels and in first century secular literature. Then Jesus himself broke into history and lived a life unlike any other human being who has ever walked the planet. He went about doing good and healing all who were oppressed by the devil, for God was with him. And then Jesus was crucified on the cross as a result of a combination of Jewish and Roman injustice, jealousy, religious zeal, and hatred. He was taken down dead. He was incarcerated in a tomb by experts who were used to burying bodies and preparing them for burial, an intimate activity. And then on the third day he rose. Now, notice two things about Peter's account. Did you see how tightly focused it is to Jesus? Not only does Peter identify Jesus in his short initial summary, Jesus Christ is Lord of all, but he also pinpoints Jesus as Jesus of Nazareth, just to avoid any confusion. And this focus of the Christian message on Jesus was a huge shock to me when I got started as a Christian, aged 18 and a half, in 1979. How dense I was. It hadn't actually twigged to me that the Christian faith might be about Jesus Christ. I sort of thought the Christian faith was about men dressed up in funny clothes in weird buildings telling me to be good or to stop having fun. Or to be ritualistic or religious. But you can't read Peter's account here without realizing it is tightly focused on Jesus, not just any Jesus, because there were lots of Jesus about in first century Israel, but Jesus of Nazareth. The one who went about, who healed the sick, who raised the dead, who turned water into wine, who walked on water. Jesus of Nazareth. If you'd asked me, I would have said, of course I'm a Christian. I'm English. I would have been the man about whom C.S. Lewis was writing in 1946. But actually, I didn't have a clue what Christianity was really all about. Jesus of Nazareth. The second thing to notice is how rooted in history it is. Verse 37, you yourselves know what happened through all Judea. Verse 39, we are witnesses of all that he did. Verse 41, not to all the people, but to us we had chosen as witnesses who ate and drank with him. We have then here an historical account, and Dr. Luke, a medical doctor, a professional man, is saying, I have examined the facts closely. This is what happened. I've spoken to the eyewitnesses. He interviewed the eyewitnesses personally. And I have recorded for you the facts of history. And here they are on the table. I have a friend, Dinesh Jivanathan, who some of you will know, half Chinese, half Indian, brought up in a Buddhist stroke Hindu home. His mother's Chinese Buddhist and his father's Hindu. And he fancied a girl, and she insisted that he come to church with her, which happens sometimes. And he went along to church. He's a very bright lad. He came over here on a scholarship from Singapore, and you'll know some of those people. They are very bright. And he was sitting in church wondering what to do with himself because he really couldn't face listening to this bloke who was wittering along from the front. And so he started to count the bricks. Well, there weren't any bricks. He thought, what shall I do? And he had a Bible, and he turned to the back of the Bible, and he found the maps. And then his brain started whirring. This, he said to himself, is unlike anything I've ever come across in religious literature before. Geography, history, people, places. So the second thing to notice under this point, the well-attested facts, is not only that it's focused on a person, Jesus, but also that we're dealing here with history. Dr. Paul Barnett, professor of ancient history in Australia, was having breakfast with him a number of years ago. I was about to speak on one of these passages that speak of the historicity of Jesus, and he said, you do realize, don't you, this makes what you are speaking on unlike any other sort of religious literature that you'll come across anywhere. Facts of history. There was a real man who was really born, who really grew up in Nazareth, a real place, who had real parents, who really did the wonderful things that are written about, who was really nailed to the cross, who really rose, who was really seen. And Peter says, this Jesus, Jesus of Nazareth, is Lord of all. Peace through Jesus Christ, who is Lord of all. So that if we were to say whether Britain or was ever Christian or William Taylor was ever Christian, we'd have to answer the question. I'm William Taylor, by the way, in case you weren't aware of that. Just well, some other bloke standing here, or I was about to be rude about William Taylor. You'd have to answer the question, well, does William Taylor actually know and submit to Jesus Christ? Because he's Lord of all. If not, C.S. Lewis's description would be really rather apt. Mere religion, morality tinged with emotion. What a man does with his solitude. The religion of all good men. I sing Jerusalem at the rugby match, and so forth. The essential message, the well-attested facts. He lived, he died, he rose. But again, facts on their own can be twisted, you say, to mean anything. I love the Bible because it's so logical. And what Peter does in this sermon is he goes to the very most obvious next logical step. And in verse 42, he gives us the God-given meaning. So glance down there, would you? And you'll find him holding out for us two authoritative sources of interpretation. He commanded us, verse 42, to preach to the people and to testify that he is the one appointed by God to be judge of the living and the dead. To him, all the prophets bear witness that everyone who believes in him receives forgiveness of sins through his name. Now, let me suggest to you that those two sentences come in precisely the reverse order of what we might be expecting. Two authoritative sources as to the meaning of the events of Jesus' life. One, Jesus himself risen from the dead. the other, the Old Testament prophets, writing before his life, death, and resurrection, of his life, death, resurrection. But these two interpretive explanations of the life of Jesus come in completely the opposite order to what most people expect. The other couple of months back, I was speaking on God as judge, and I'd explained, I hope clearly, that we would expect God to judge if there is God at all. That we're not heading round and round in circles, that there will be a day of accounting and every one of us will have to give an account of ourselves to God. That's what you would expect if there was a God. And I was speaking from over there, and just by that pillar at the end of the meeting, somebody came up to me and said, "Ah, I see you believe in the God of the Old Testament, the God of judgment. I believe in the God of the New Testament, the God of forgiveness." Now look at verse 42. "He commanded us to preach to the people and to testify that he is the one appointed by God to be judge of the living and the dead." Who commanded us to preach that Jesus is the one appointed to be the judge of the living and the dead? Jesus did. What is New Testament Christianity? Jesus is judge of all. And so then, Jesus' message to us, Peter's message to us, is that at the end of the time there will be an accounting. God will not allow this world simply to bumble along forever. And Jesus' resurrection from the dead is evidence that he is the one appointed by God to be my judge and yours. I wonder if you could look at the last four words of that sentence 42, judge of the living and the dead. Can you think of anybody outside of the set, the living and the dead? You may feel your next door neighbour fits into his, or maybe your teenage daughter or son as you try to wake him during half term or something like that. But there is actually nobody outside of the set, the living and the dead. And so here is the first authoritative voice of interpretation from the risen Jesus himself who has defeated death. You would expect that we want to listen to somebody who has risen from the dead, and he says, "My resurrection means that God has appointed me as judge of the living and the dead." And the second authoritative voice comes from the Old Testament. Now look at the message of the Old Testament, verse 43. "To Jesus, all the prophets bear witness that everyone who believes in him receives forgiveness of sins through his name." So that the Old Testament prophets, writing for hundreds and indeed thousands of years before the coming of Christ, pointed to one who would die and rise, and the meaning of whose death would be that God has provided a way by which you and I can be forgiven and have peace with God, friendship with God, restored relationship with God. One was coming from God, whose death would be a sacrificial death, such that he carried God's judgment at my sin and yours, my rebellion and yours, my refusal and yours to treat God as he ought to be treated. And that one would both die and rise as evidence that forgiveness is available from God. Now notice how universal this is, everyone who believes in him. Notice how focused it is. Everyone who believes in him receives forgiveness of sins in his name. And notice what good news it is. Peace, friendship, relationship is available with the creator of the universe through Jesus Christ, who has died on a cross, risen from the dead, such that we can be forgiven and have friendship with our Creator. You know, people often say to me, "Oh, you preach in the business district of the City of London," and they assume that all of you are loaded and haven't got a care in the world. You know that. We all know that. Everybody out there assumes everybody in the City of London is absolutely loaded and hasn't got a care in the world. And they say to me, "Well, what on earth has the Christian message got to say to people in the City of London?" And I say, it's got absolutely everything to say to people in the city of London. And the God-given interpretation of the well-attested facts which constitute the essential message of the Christian faith show us that it's got everything to say to people like you and me. You will meet God in judgment. The living and the dead will meet God, and there is nobody who is not included in that set. And God has given evidence of that by raising Jesus from the dead. And if you have any integrity about you, surely you would say, wouldn't you, that you have not lived up to the perfect standards of a holy God? And therefore, the thing you and I need more than anything else is forgiveness. And here is the essential message of the Christian faith. Peace with God through Jesus Christ, who is Lord of all. Well, our time is up. We began, is Britain Christian? I noted it is undeniable that huge tranches of our heritage is Christian. And yet it is undeniable that so much of that is gone. And so I took resort in C.S. Lewis's famous essay, The Decline of Religion, 1946. Amazing, it was 1946. How prescient of him. And in his essay he suggested, and he really was a close studier of men and women like you and me, that actually what had been lost in Britain was not actually real Christianity. And so I said, well, what about us picking up real Christianity and asking ourselves, well, what is authentic Christianity? Here is authentic Christianity according to the Apostle Peter, upon whose teaching Jesus said he would build his church. Is Britain Christian? The essential message, Jesus Christ is Lord of all. The well-attested facts, Jesus of Nazareth, who lived and died, who rose. The God-given meaning, he will judge every one of us. Forgiveness is available in his name. And therefore, I think what we have to say is that this presentation of the Christian message leaves us with a far, far more important question than a question about Britain. Surely the most pressing question before we get to Britain is, am I Christian? Because according to the risen Lord Jesus, whose resurrection gives him pretty good authority to speak to us, when I die, I will not simply meet my Maker, I will meet Jesus. And Jesus, in his kindness, has entered into this world ahead of time, before Judgment Day, to provide a way in which I can be forgiven and meet him as my friend rather than as my judge. Well, that's as far as I've got, and I hope the question times is going to help us a great deal. I'm sure you'll have a lot of ideas about whether Britain is Christian and so forth. And you might like to talk about over the next few minutes as we enjoy dessert together. You might like to talk about the kind of questions you would like to ask or your own views on the subject, and then we'll have a bit of discussion in a few moments' time. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, William, very much. So just to say, two things are going to happen now. First of all, this would be the moment to write down your questions. In the middle of your tables, you'll find slips of paper which have questions written on the top, and you can just make use of the pens to record your questions, and then the waiters will take them from you, will gather them together, and in the next few minutes accumulate them, give William the chance to look at them, and then come and answer them. The other thing that's going to happen is pudding is going to come to your tables now, so relax and enjoy that for the next few minutes. Good, let me bring us together there. Good, I hope you enjoyed your dessert. It was always, it just clicked. It was always going to be roast beef and apple crumble, wasn't it? There you go. Took me a few seconds. I've got a great pile of questions, and we're going to work through them with William in a couple of minutes' time. Before we do that, though, let me mention a couple of things that you might be interested to hear about. I suspect things have been said tonight that may have piqued your interest and made you think, I'd value the chance to look more into that. To that end, we run regularly here at St. Helens a course called Christianity Explored, which is very straightforward, very simple, and very relaxed. It's a chance over a number of weeks to get together with a group of other people who want to look into the Christian faith, to ask lots of questions, listen to a short talk, and have a look at a short bit of Mark's Gospel. It happens on Wednesday evenings in a building just over the road from here, St. Andrew's, another church building that we have use of. And it started last week and carries on now for the next 6 weeks. So it's certainly not too late to join in on a Wednesday evening if you'd like to go along. Like I said, it's very relaxed and informal, and a chance really to get along and look into things and ask any question that you might have. Flyers for that are available on the table as you go through the door over there. There is also a course starting up on a Sunday morning, if that's a better time or day for you. Next Sunday morning for 3 weeks, meeting in what's called the Hiscox Cafe. So just across the road from here, just over there. Turn up to St. Helens and people will point you in the right direction. So Christianity Explored, if you would appreciate the chance to look more deeply into these things. There's a table I mentioned just on the door as you go out on your left, and there are a whole load of resources there as well that, again, might be useful to you if you want to look into these things, questions that deal with lots of the big questions that people have. So as you make your way out through that door, do feel free to pause and have a look and take away any of the resources that would be useful. And on those tables, you'll find copies of Mark's Gospel, one of the eyewitness accounts to the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And really, that is the best place to start if you want to look into Christian things in a bit more detail. And we'd love you to take away one of these Mark's Gospels for yourself and to have a read of it. Or even better, perhaps, to ask the person who brought you tonight whether you might be able to sit down with them and have a read of it together. You can throw your questions as they come up at that person, and I'm sure they'd be delighted to go through that with you. So grab hold of Mark's Gospel, ask a friend if you could read it with them, and that would be a very good way of looking into these things in a bit more detail. Good, I'm going to invite William up, and we're going to start throwing some of these questions at him. Okay, yeah. We'll start with a pointed question. So William, do you think Britain is Christian?
Yes. And no. I think it's a profoundly unhelpful question, but it was asked by our politicians, and so I thought it's quite a helpful way to grasp that it is unhelpful. I don't think you can talk about nations being Christian. You talk about individuals responding to the command of Jesus to turn to him, recognize him as Lord, and to receive the forgiveness he offers. But we don't talk about nations being Christian. That's you simply can't do that, because Christianity is about a personal relationship with the living Creator God through the person of his Son, Jesus, who is Lord of all. And therefore, I need to start not with the question, is Britain Christian, but am I Christian? If there is any semblance of Christian heritage in our country, that heritage came from individual Christians who had a real relationship with the Lord Jesus, actually giving many, in a lot of cases, giving their lives for the truth of the Christian gospel. And anybody who's done any history will know that. So, yeah.
Okay, thank you. This question follows on in a sense then. If everyone in Britain was a Christian, would it be better or worse, and why? Would Britain be better if everyone read the Bible?
Well, I mean, here's a really... If... Think of the teaching of Jesus, the Sermon on the Mount. Love your enemies. Where else do you find that? So, do good to those who persecute you. If anybody asks you to go 1 mile, offer to go another. If any takes you from you your tunic, give him your shirt as well. Honour your father and mother. You shall not commit adultery. Think of that. Just the teaching that Jesus upheld. It is beautiful. And I think I would challenge you to find anything like it in the world. So if everybody in Britain was Christian, we would not be in heaven. It wouldn't be perfect. We still live in a world that is profoundly broken as a result of our human rebellion against God. But boy, would it be a better place. Think of the city. If anybody asks you for tunic, give them your shirt as well. There we go.
Okay, I'm looking forward to this one.
Integrity. Look at integrity. Truth. Don't let your yes be yes and your no be no. If the city is able to stand on anything, my word is my bond. If you lose my word is my bond, the city's bust. And that's why there are so many, why solvency, all this sort of stuff. Why all of this? Well, if you lose my word is my bond, you're bust. And you lose integrity. Have a look at The Apprentice. Yeah, and ask yourself, would it be better if everybody was Christian? Love your enemy.
Good. As I said, I'm looking forward to this one. You've paused on it for a moment, but we're going to get to it. Is the rise of UKIP a sign that Christianity is declining in Britain?
Well, I think the rise of UKIP has a lot to do with very weak leadership. When you don't have strong leadership, then all sorts of things abound. And we'll see that all over. We see that all over Europe at the moment. The rise of UKIP isn't just a British thing; it's all over. So I think it has much more to do with weak leadership than it does with anything else.
A couple of people have asked this question. You said that only Christianity deals with history and geography. What about Islam?
Yes, I didn't quite put it like that. I think I quoted Paul Barnett, who over breakfast said, when I was speaking on the beginning of Luke's Gospel, Dr. Luke, wrote both Luke and Acts, two volumes, both written by the same guy, Dr. Luke, a medical doctor, who travelled with Paul. Listen to what he says at the start of his Gospel. It'll be familiar to lots of us. Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus. Now, in the first century, history had to be eyewitness material, or received from eyewitness, in other words, courtroom testimonial, in order to be accounted as history. So Luke, in his introduction, is setting himself up, as Polybius does, and Tacitus. You read any history of the first century era, that's how they set themselves out. Eyewitness. I've interviewed. He acted as what you might call an investigative historian. And what I'm saying by geography and history is, this is, if you like, to some degree falsifiable. You can check it out. So he mentions place names. He mentions people. It's not kind of just coming to us, to an individual in a cave with no verification and falsifiable possibility. It's not self-conscious myth. Hinduism is self-conscious myth. Buddhism is self-conscious, it's human philosophy. Buddhism is an atheistic religion, as we know. This is falsifiable. I have friends with a holiday home in Turkey, and they say, you would have to have been there to write parts of Acts the way Luke writes them. You couldn't have done it third or fourth hand, because you had to know the trade winds, and etc., and you read it. Look at the place names, the people's names. Somebody's done some research on this. How many people's names there are per 1,000 words in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and how many people's names there are in the what are known as the Gnostic Gospels of the second century, which are myth. And the people's names in Matthew, Mark, and Luke is like this, and the people's names in the Gnostic Gospels is like this. You can't put in people's names if you're writing eyewitness material. If the eyewitnesses are still alive and around you, you can't afford to do it if actually you're writing myth. Because people will say, like they did with Nancy, the Reagan thingos or the Hitler diaries, well, they'll say, that's a load of baloney. I was there and it wasn't Paul or it wasn't Peter. They're actually people, you see. So this is falsifiable historically, geographically, meteorologically, botanically. You know, there are particular names of trees that can only be grown in a particular place. Now, you could say, oh, well, they just made it all up. And they invented a form of writing, the historical fiction, that we only then saw again in the 16th century. Out of the blue, four people independently, they invented a whole new genre of writing. You can say that, but I'm going to say to you, well, hang on a second, at that point, I think you're believing more unbelievable things than I am. So unlike self-conscious myth, Hinduism, human philosophy, Buddhism, or this is a revelation received in a cave which actually cannot be tested, do you see? You can hold this up against. And that's what Dinesh was saying when he said, I've been brought up in a Buddhist Hindu home, and this is unlike anything I've ever seen before. Does that help?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. You may feel like you've just answered this. There may be more you want to add. How can we be sure that what is written in the Bible is true? Do you want to add? You may feel like you just answered that.
Well, I think... we'll come on to that in a moment. I think I'd want to look at the eyewitnesses themselves. What kind of people were they? This issue of inventing a form of literature that was not then seen for another 1500 years is quite a big issue. If the Gospels are actually some sort of historical fiction, then you have to concede that this was invented. It wasn't seen again, literature of this sort. So I want to look at the disciples, the eyewitnesses. They're well represented. There are lots of them. They're reformed. That is, they've radically changed their lives. What have they got to gain? They stuck to their story. They didn't shift. A friend of mine says he'd met Chuck Colson, you know, who was there with Nixon, and Colson says that within, I think it's 78 hours, having sworn that they would stick to their story, under the threat of severe punishment, at least one of them had blown the cover. Oh, these guys stuck to their story. Now, yeah, one of those things on its own isn't enough for me. I mean, I think I'd say, well, hang on, I'm sure they did, maybe they could. But when you put one on another and another and another and another, you're then saying, well, if you were in court weighing this evidence, the evidence seems to stack up. So, yeah.
Someone asks, how do we know Jesus is actually the Son of God because of what he did? Couldn't he have just been an alien or a time traveller or magician? I guess Doctor Who, maybe. But people at the time just didn't understand it.
Yeah. Thank you very much for that question. It is a very... I mean, I know people smile at it. But I think it's a really good question because it touches on the issue of interpretation. Would you please take hold of Peter's sermon again that you've got in your hands there? And this comes over and over again in the Acts of the Apostles and in the teaching of Jesus. So you'll find this all the way through Luke's Gospel. Remember what Luke said at the beginning of his Gospel? The things that have been accomplished among us? So Jesus didn't just sort of drop as an alien from outer space without precedent into history. The events of... Look at this last sentence, 43... To him, all the prophets bear witness that everyone who believes in him receives forgiveness of sins throughout his name. That is, this is what the theologians call, there is a meta-narrative. That's a very clever way of saying there's a big story. And Jesus has got 2,000 years before his arrival of statements and prophecy and anticipation of his arrival that enables us to know that we've made sense of what he did rightly. If Jesus just arrived from outer space, just dropped into history, it seems a bit, doesn't it, like he's a bit of an alien. But actually, if for 2,000 years before his arrival, we've got developed, as humanity began to develop the ability to record these things and so forth, statements from God saying, by the way, I will come, I will visit my creation, I will come in the form of a king, a messiah, I will have my king, my Messiah, die for sin, etc., etc., etc. Then when Jesus comes, there's this, what the theologians call a grand meta-narrative, which is interpretative for us. And have we got time for me just to put one more
point
in?
Briefly.
I mean, the story I have used recently is of, you know, the Qatar kind of FIFA fix-up stuff? You know, the Sunday Times can say, oh, there's been a huge Qatar FIFA fix-up. And we say, well, you know, yeah, some people received some money, but maybe the blokes in Qatar had sold a watch to somebody in Africa, or maybe the blokes in Qatar had, do you see what I mean, and they received some money for it. But if then the Sunday Times manages to produce 3,000 emails, or whatever it is, as they say they can, saying, I will meet you on the 3rd of October, I'll have a brown paper bag, and in the brown paper bag will be loads of wodge, or whatever, if you vote for me, do you see then there's a meta-narrative. And you say, now we understand why the money transferred. And the Old Testament provides us with that interpretative grid so that Jesus steps into history in a way that we can understand him. Sorry, that was a long way.
Thank you. A couple of people asked questions along these lines. So what about the atheists who lived a good life but made an informed decision not to believe in Jesus? Or slightly more pointedly, what if I don't believe I've done anything wrong?
Yeah, thank you very much. Now, that question is asked of me more and more often. And I think I can understand why it's asked. So if you look at the Ten Commandments, which are a kind of statement from God of his spiritual and moral standards, you will note that the first four all have to do with God. So the first commandment, you shall have no other God before me. The second commandment, you shall not make for yourself an idol, that's anything of your own making, and worship it. Give it your undivided devotion. The third commandment, you shall not take my name in vain, O God, O Christ. The fourth commandment, keep the Sabbath. Do you notice that the first four commandments of the Ten Commandments are all vertical and they're all to do with God? When Jesus was asked, what is the greatest commandment of all? He said this, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul and strength. And so to God, as creator, the most offensive thing you and I can do is to refuse to recognize him as God. And William Taylor, that's me, I do that all the time. I live in his world as if he doesn't exist. I get on with my life my own way. I reject him and his loving rule. There is nothing more offensive to God than that. Once you lose an understanding of God, the creator, so we forget that there is a vertical element to morality, God. And then I start to say, well, you know, I haven't done anyone any harm. We take the second six. But then when you look at the second six, of course, we redefine the second six. You shall not commit adultery. Jesus said, if you so much as look at a woman with lust in your eyes, you've already committed adultery with her in your heart. That's where adultery begins. So have you done that? So now we begin to redefine, say, oh, well, it just means as long as we sort of love the person we sleep with, you see? And now we're ignoring God and we're now changing his standards and we're saying, well, actually, yeah, I think I keep his standards, but actually the standards I'm saying I keep are not his standards at all, they're my standards, which, to be honest, are pretty weak. So I don't think there is such a thing as a person. What was the question exactly?
The atheist who's lived a good life but made an informed decision not to believe in Jesus.
Yeah, I think that question is self-contradictory. If you operated in your firm, let's imagine you were an accountant. Sorry, I won't comment on that. Let's imagine you were an accountant. Yes. Imagine you were an accountant. Man, you worked in KPMG. Who is CEO of KPMG at the moment? I can't think. Simon, do you know who CEO is? Well, let's imagine you operated in KPMG as an accountant, and secretly you were actually doing all your work for yourself and not KPMG. Would you be a good accountant? You could say, I'm a really good accountant, but you're operating in KPMG and you're squirreling away all the funds for yourself. Do you see? So if we're operating in God's world, the fundamental basis of morality has to do with God himself. And if I say, well, I refuse to recognise you, that's a moral decision as far as God is concerned. Now, you may not agree with me, but that's the Christian position.
Okay, so this I think follows on. Why does God need to judge? As in, why can't God just get over it? Why is he so bothered about all of this?
Yeah. Well, I think the newspapers show us every day that we are profoundly concerned with justice. You know, I noticed when Jimmy Savile was exposed, they desecrated his grave. That's really interesting, isn't it? I mean, I don't mean that's terrible. It makes it sound as if it's the academic interest. But isn't it striking that they desecrated his grave? It shows that we are profoundly concerned with justice. So, you know, the Rotherham Abuse Inquiry, we are hugely... you're concerned with justice. I take it you are. And your concern with justice is just a faint shimmer, an indication that you're a created being and you've been created by the God who is deeply concerned with justice. And if you remove God and justice from a culture, might is right, anything goes. Who are you to tell me that what I'm doing is wrong? I mean, I happen to think that X is fine. There is no God. Why do you decide you should decide what's right and I should be judged? Because you think you're more powerful. Actually, that's ultimately what all you've got to rest on. And once you lose a doctrine of creation, you lose a doctrine of judgment. But the creator God who made the universe is, you know, passionately concerned for justice. And the curtain will fall. You know, we are not circular. We're not. That's the Hindu view, the Buddhist view. We are linear. Time is limited. And God has set a day when he will judge the world in justice by the man he's appointed, and he's given evidence of that by raising that man, Jesus, from the dead. And so the curtain will fall, the clock will stop, and you will meet your maker, and so will I.
Yeah. We've got about 5 more minutes, I think.
Good.
So we're gonna we've got a handful. We may not make it through them all, but we'll do our best. If my religion is based on Christianity, is there anything wrong with that? As in, following rules is easier than the broader concept.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, there is something wrong with that, and that is you don't keep the rules. So I hope we've answered that effectively. You know, Christianity, A, is not about following the rules, because actually if you want to have religion based on following the rules are love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your mind, all your soul, all your strength. Love your neighbour as yourself. Now, I don't do that. And to be honest, I don't believe you do either. I don't believe you. In fact, I don't think we live according to even our rather own personal feeble standards. We just don't. We don't. And,
A couple of people asked this question, springing out of Peter's sermon. What does Lord of all really mean, and why is this important?
Well, Lord of all, it's a good question. I think because we have difficulty with authority and so forth in our culture, it's hard. But he made everything. He governs everything. He demands my submission and surrender. Now, you might say, well, that's a despot. No, it isn't. He loves me. He sent his son to die for me. He is passionately concerned for me. So it is loving rule. It is kind authority. It is... And Lord of all means... everything and everybody. He rules and governs the whole show from beginning to end. One of the Bible books, John the Apostle, talks about him as the Alpha and the Omega, the first letter and the last letter, the A and the Z, the beginning and the end, Lord of all. It's all his. He owns it all. He made it all. Your firm, your career, your bank balance, it's actually really his. My life, my family, my career. No. It's his. It's his life. And it's on loan to me. And I live in his world at his permission, if you like. I'm a tenant. It's all his. He's Lord of all.
Can you give us the beginnings of an answer to this question? It follows on. If Jesus is Lord of all, why is there so much suffering?
Oh, my God.
Just start us off. Give us a...
Thank you for that. Good luck. This, as we had earlier. That's exactly right. Well, I think I would always want to start... I mean, I have made such a horlicks in answering these questions in the past. I would always want to start by saying God loves humanity. He loves us. He loves us enough to send his son to die for us. He understands suffering more deeply than you or I will ever understand, because he has suffered the greatest injustice, the greatest weight of unjust punishment, the greatest loss. He's suffered more than... So when we're talking about suffering, we're not talking about a kind of distant, removed God with his arm folded over his fat tummy, smiling down benignly at this world. We're talking about the God who's actually got his hands dirty. And there will be people here who, you know, are either presently or have been through the most horrific suffering. And I want to say, you know, the God of the Bible understands where you're at. And he's been there in person, in the person of Jesus, and he loves you and he cares for you. So I think I've made such a horlicks of that in the past by kind of talking theoretically before we talk about that. I think then I want to talk about this world and human rebellion against the Creator. And that if the linchpin or if the kind of pinnacle of God's creation is humanity, and God has entrusted the care of his creation to us as sub-regents, our rebellion against God affects far more than simply our little world. It affects the whole of creation. And so as humanity, as we shake our fist at God, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. Oh, Christ. As I rebel against God and shake my fist at God, it's like, you know, when you throw a coin at a mirror. Sorry, I know you don't throw it at a coin, but were you to throw a coin at a mirror, it shatters, and the impact of that rebellion are felt everywhere. Because, you know, a spanner has been thrown into the workings of the machine, if you like. So why is there so much suffering? That, but in his extraordinary love for us, the God of eternity has stepped into this world. And why you are suffering, it's not because you, it's a horrible idea that you have done something particularly wicked. You can't draw that direct line. But God loves us and has stepped in and done something about it in the person of his son, Jesus.
Lots of resources on our website if you want to look into that more and get a deeper answer. There are talks on that particular subject easily found. I think we've got time for two more questions. I apologise, there are two or three questions we haven't got to and two or three helpful comments. William will be around for the rest of the evening, so do come and grab him or me or carry these conversations on around your tables if you'd like to. Let me give you two questions to close. The first is this: if I want to be forgiven, like you said, how can that actually happen?
Well, I wonder if you might just have a look at the first sentence and the last sentence. Verse 35, because how can I be forgiven? I think when you begin to ask that question, you're on the right track. Not how can I be forgiven, but how could I possibly be forgiven? If you knew my rebellion against God. In every nation, anyone who fears him and does what is right is acceptable to him. Doing what is right here is submitting to Jesus as Lord. And as I submit to him, and then verse 43, everyone who believes in him receives forgiveness of sins through his name. So it's a matter of trust. We're too far off to talk about Christmas, but hey. There is the present waiting under the tree. You've actually got to trust enough to open it in order to receive it. I find that is never too great a difficulty for me or my children. But here it is. Forgiveness is available as a result of Jesus' death on the cross. Will you open it? Will you receive it? Will you trust? Will you believe? To do that would be to do the right thing. To do what is right. To submit to Jesus and receive the forgiveness he offers.
And then this question was given to me as I came up, and we'll close with it. How does one move or show others how to move from blind Christianity to authentic Christianity?
Well, in one sense, it happens in a simple prayer. You know, it could happen for you tonight if you simply said, Jesus, I recognize you are my rightful Lord. I'm sorry that I have not lived like that. Please forgive me. Come into my life. Something like that. I recognize, I'm sorry, please forgive me. So that's a prayer, isn't it? Anyone who believes in him and receives forgiveness in his name. Just that simple step of trust. And then you're in the family. In another sense, it's a whole lifetime, isn't it? That then there's a whole lifetime of growing and a whole lifetime of walking with Jesus as Lord. So a prayer, a sincere prayer. Jesus, I recognize your Lord. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. And then to walk with him.
William, thank you. We ran out of time about 2 or 3 minutes ago, so thank you very much for your answers. As I've said, William is going to be around for the rest of the evening. Please feel free to come and grab him to ask more questions if you would like to. That's it for the formal part of our evening. Let me remind you, there are Mark's Gospels on the table over there. I see you've got copies of Luke's Gospel on your tables. We'd love you to take that away with you and read it. Be our guest. Consider it our gift to you. Do grab hold of one, take it away, and read it. It'd only take you an hour or two to do that. Similarly, Christianity Explored, I mentioned. If you would like to sign up for that, the course has just started on Wednesday nights from 7 o'clock in St. Andrews, or next Sunday morning for 3 weeks in the Hiscox Cafe over the road. Great ways to keep looking into these things, to keep the dialogue and the discussion going. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. I hope you had a good time. Hopefully see you again. We meet on Sundays at 10:30, 4 o'clock and 6 o'clock, and we'd love to see you then. Thanks very much.